hey, we got a new super cool party people only giveaway for
you. It's only for party people. If you are not a party person, you just don't listen.
Get out.
Yeah.
A fun March giveaway for y'all, because we just like to give stuff away. It's just like a fun little way to spice things up.
It is. And March is just like a cool month.
Yeah. You know? Like, Ides of March and
St. Patrick's Day.
I don't know why my brain went there.
Like, I don't either. That was unique.
Yeah. St. Patrick's Day is probably a more festive. Yeah. So for our March giveaway, we've got some cool stuff. We have a Art History Babes t-shirt in black.
Classic black.
We have a really cool book about some, it's drawings by some Venetian masters.
Tiepolo. Yeah.
Ginny on the Italian over there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've also got a Rauschenberg inspired mug, some white sage for witchy vibes, also just general good smells.
Yeah.
White sage, cone incense, not actual white sage.
Yes, yeah, incense vibes. And we got a Norman Rockwell puzzle. So really a wide array of of
arts-related goods.
Feast.
Yeah, definitely. For you. Definitely. It's a fun giveaway, I think. And to be entered to win, all you have to do is head over to our Patreon, patreon.com/arthistorybabes, and become a patron and help support the production of this podcast and other Art History Babes content. Every dollar that you pledge to the Art History Babes is an entry. So $1 a month, that's one entry. $5 mm-hmm. a month, that's five entries. And if you're wondering yourself, hey, I'm already a patron, I'm screwed. I can't be a part of this super cool party people giveaway. You're not. All you got to do is up your pledge. If you up your pledge by a couple dollars, then you get a couple entries. So everyone has a chance to enter however many times you would like. This is for the duration of March. So from March 1st to March 31st.
Mm. That feels right.
Yeah, there's 31 days of March. If you get on our Patreon from the 1st through the 31st, your entries will be counted, and then at the beginning of April, we will pull a name out of a hat. It's going to be a good time.
It is.
From Cabernet to Mollet, they're here to slay the Art History Babes.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Corey.
I'm Natalie.
I'm Ginny.
And I'm Jen.
And we are the Art History Babes.
And we're all back together.
We're all together. This is crazy. It's been a while.
It has been a while.
It's been a while. God, I can't escape that song.
I don't know why. Like, we were just having a conversation about how that song just keeps coming up.
Just permeates into my consciousness.
Oh, stained.
Stained will never die.
Oh, my God.
What a disturbing sentence.
Oh, man. We're having the nicest time right now.
We're having a little winter extravaganza.
It's our little...
it's our holiday party.
This is like our holiday party today.
It's snowing outside.
Yeah, it's a nice 70 degrees in Sacramento, California.
Yeah, I was like sweating when we were outside.
Me too. I'm a little bit sweaty right now.
We climbed a log. You climbed a rock.
We got on a tree.
We climbed a tree.
Yeah.
We climbed a hill.
Extreme. That was extreme. extreme sports with the Art History Babes.
Parkour.
Parkour. we're just posted up at Natalie's beautiful home, and we're by the fire, and there's a Christmas tree, and there's a bag full of Meyer lemons for all of us to take home.
Yes.
And I'm very excited about that. I'm putting lemons in everything.
Oh, everything.
Yeah. Lemons.
There's a never-ending supply.
Drinks. Lemon chicken.
Lemon
pasta.
I actually have a really good chicken recipe that involves lemon that I can send to you guys.
Yeah.
Full chicken. Guys, I made a full chicken twice.
Word.
And I
Bravo.
Wow, very nice.
That's not for the faint of heart.
I've done that before. I almost burned my house down. It was an extreme. Ooh. Yeah.
Did you have to pull out its innards?
One of them, it came with a liver. The other one came with nothing. Cool. The liver was a little gross, caught me off guard.
Yeah, liver is not delicious.
That one also had a neck still, which grossed me out as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
So if you like moved it right, its little neck would go up and down. Yeah, not pleasant at all.
No, thank you.
Wow.
Yeah, my mom likes to buy the chickens with all the guts in them, and she makes like a souffle for the dogs, and they lose their minds. She, you know, because
dogs love that shit.
It's true. You know, my mom is from Mexico, and in Mexico, it's rare that you feed your dog food. Dogs just get whatever shit you don't eat. And
makes sense.
They live forever.
Yeah.
Like, they're healthy down there. Yeah. Don't feed your dogs dog food, you guys. It's not good for them.
They're eating real food.
They're eating wheat.
Feed them some chicken liver.
Dogs shouldn't be eating wheat. That's crazy. Like,
that's
come on.
True. It's insane.
Anyway.
Corn. So much corn in dog food.
Yeah. True.
So much corn in human food. Corn is everywhere,
that's
man.
True.
I mean,
I made
if
corn.
It was if it was a
yeah, I might be too.
We are all fairly made
Matthew
of corn.
And I eat a lot of popcorn, guys.
If it was made of like maize, like our
a maize.
That is supposed to be pretty good for you. Like original corn is supposed to be pretty good for you.
Yeah, this is like the
GMO.
Yeah, GMO stuff.
Garbage corn.
I do miss corn on the cob though. Corn on the cob is like such an like Midwest Iowa thing, obviously, because we're just surrounded by corn all
the
time.
Yeah,
you are. So like corn on the cob is like a big deal. I could go for some cob.
Some cob.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you seen that episode of Rick and Morty where they land on the cob planet?
No. What?
They go to a planet where everything is on a cob and they
I do not recall this episode. I thought so I've seen funny. Every episode.
And then they like lose their minds like when they realize as though it's like this really bad thing. They're like, everything's on a cob. Go, go, go. They like have to get out of there. It's
That's
ridiculous.
Pretty good. It's yeah. pretty good.
It's pretty good.
You know what else is pretty good? We're drinking this really delicious like holiday Jack Daniels, which I never thought I would say delicious and Jack Daniels in the same sentence.
Right?
So that's cool. We're getting a little bit saucy because we're getting ready to talk about a pretty exciting episode, an episode we've been wanting to do for a long time. Like
we've mentioned it.
God, since
before.
We started the podcast, we've we want to do this episode.
I think it was like one of our first ideas.
It was. I know. I was like, how did it take so long to get here? But we were just preserving our strength.
And yeah, I think it was one of them that we knew it was going to be like so good that we didn't want to rush it. Like we wanted it to be at the right time when we could be in it. And and here we are by the fire and we're having this lovely gathering. And I think it's time to lay in. To Paul Gauguin.
Yeah. So. It's time. We're maturing as recording artists. And we're ready to...
Ready to take this on.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, given all of these, like, sexual assault and harassment that have really been surfacing in the news as far as victims coming
timely.
Forward. It's time.
It is definitely time.
Yeah.
Fucking reveal...
I think that
Paul Gauguin was a pervy pedophile.
Oh, Lord. Yeah. I mean, I think we posted something on our Facebook a while back about, you know, what do we do with the art of reprehensible men?
Yeah. And it was an article that focused a lot on Woody Allen, which is one that I do struggle with.
Yeah.
Because like... that's why I really liked that article because I like Woody Allen movies.
Yeah.
And I can't like Woody Allen movies. Like, he's a piece of garbage.
That's
like,
how I feel when I listen to R. Kelly. I'm like, I love the song.
No.
It's like, dang it.
No more R. Kelly.
I don't listen to him anymore.
I know. Yeah. I mean, I spent my teen years singing Remix to Ignition, too.
Dude, Feeling on Yo Booty was my party song.
I know.
You know.
Like, I've heard you sing it.
You know, can't enjoy classic episodes of the Today Show.
Oh.
So pissed about that.
Matt. He was like kind of one of America's like sweethearts, kind of. He was well loved.
He was,
you know?
You kind of knew he was an asshole, but you didn't think he was a pervert.
Yeah.
Because he would make those little comments that, like, did you guys see the video of him interviewing Anne Hathaway resurfaced?
No.
When Les Mis came out? That's like all over since this has happened. And it's basically like a paparazzi guy took a picture of her getting out of a car, like basically up her dress, like ooh, just an upshot.
No.
And it like, instead of deleting it, he sold it. And of course he just did. Scummy. And she comes on the Today Show. The first thing that Matt Lauer says to her is like, we've been seeing a lot of you lately.
Oh,
like something
Lord.
Like that. And he was like, what did you learn from that situation or something? Like what? Trying to
oh
like,
my God.
Yeah. And you can tell she's just like trying to stay composed, but like you fucking did.
I haven't seen the picture. Is it? Is
I
she,
haven't either. I don't even remember
is
it
she
happening.
Exposed.
It doesn't matter. What
yeah.
The picture
it was just
like.
The attitude.
I'm just curious.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
that's gross.
And at the time, yeah, you could be like, oh, he was just kind of being an asshole or just like sounded no, like yeah. a jerk. And now you're like, oh no, he just thinks women are sexual objects.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, regardless, what's kind of fun about all this?
It's fun.
Yeah, it's fun. What's fun about all this is we are going back and we are looking at all of these things, even from the past 10 years that we just brushed off because it's yeah. mm-hmm. what it's like to be a woman.
Right.
And finally, because everyone's standing up, we're like, no, like this no. isn't okay.
This
and
will not stand.
Exactly.
This aggression yeah. will not stand. And we're ready
yeah,
to talk
I mean,
about
it's that
it.
Whole stupid thing like boys will be boys.
No.
Nope.
No, they won't. No.
Nope. No.
No.
Like, just no.
Yeah,
boys will be decent human beings.
Yeah,
let's
boys,
go with that for
boys
a while.
Will be,
let's try
will
that
be
one
humans.
Out.
Like, they will be held to the same standards as everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the most recent episode of SNL, they did this funny thing with all the females, like all the
yes.
all the girls
the
on
like
the show.
Song.
Yeah,
yes.
they did the song, and it's like them as like they're all dolled up like this like pop group,
yeah.
like girl pop group.
Yeah,
and but it's talking about basically how because now men feel like everything's falling apart for them, and it's basically how like this has always been what it's been like to be a woman, and the like tagline is welcome to hell. And it's like in this like poppy happy voice. It's like really it's good, it's really good because it just points out like all those things about being a woman in like a predatory society that we think about every day, every
yeah.
minute of mm-hmm. the day, that men, it never crosses their mind.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, that is real. And I think that that is something that women have been told for their whole lives that you can just expect.
Mm-hmm.
Just expect to be sexually harassed and scared around groups of men. And that's bullshit. And so I think...
Put a stop to it.
It's our responsibility now as art historians to tackle this problem of what do we do with the art of horrible men.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to start today
with a big one.
Oh, Lord. We're going to start with Paul Gauguin. And God damn it. I hate him.
I hate him so much.
God.
So Jenny, you want to take it away?
Yeah, let's talk about the origins of this piece of shit a little bit. So
in the beginning.
Gauguin was born in 1848. His grandmother was actually Peruvian, and he later touted that part of his ancestry as a way to make himself appear to be an exotic artistic figure. Mm. He did live part of his young life on his uncle's like grand estate in Lima, but his family moved back to France later. And, you know, he had a relatively privileged upbringing. He was exposed to art at a fairly young age and, you know, was taking painting lessons and meeting artists, but did become a stockbroker. And so he married a Danish woman and she bore him 5 children. He met the artist Pissarro in 1874 and was really like artistically smitten with him and learned a lot from him. And he later like pays homage to Pissarro and his work. So out of the impressionist painters, Gauguin really dug Paul Cézanne and bought several of his paintings. He was actually one of like the first major like collectors of Cézanne. So he becomes like part of this kind of like French impressionist circle. He's not initially super active with them. Like he learns from them. They seem to enjoy his company, I guess.
He's buying their art.
He's buying their shit. You know, he's probably stroking their egos like, wow, you're so smart. But he's still going to the bank and working
mm-hmm.
there. He did exhibit a landscape at the salon in 1876, and he participated in group exhibitions. Up until like 1878, his color palette was really a lot more subdued than what you normally would associate with a lot of Gauguin paintings, where they're very brightly colored and there's like these big swatches of bright colors, whereas originally they were kind of more like grayscale and earth tone. He was, you know, doing pretty good. So he's getting more involved with the Impressionists. He's showing a bit of his stuff. He's hanging out with artists. But then the stock market crashed and he lost his job. And he moved to Copenhagen with his wife to live with his in-laws. But the Danes really weren't into Impressionism at this time. They just were like, no, maybe in France, but not here.
Mm-hmm.
And so he ditched his wife, just left her high Goodbye. And dry, and came back to Paris in 1885. Then he moved to Brittany for a while for a less stressful life. He was pretty productive there and fine-tuned his skills and developed more complex compositions. And he was practicing plein air painting, so going outside, painting out in the nature and all of that. He went to Martinique and got a taste for the tropics, which, you know, is a theme that we'll see later with him. And then he kind of had this break with Impressionism when he painted Vision After the Sermon. And he was really influenced by another artist named Emile Bernard. And Bernard painted Breton women in the meadow. And essentially, like, this technique involved, like, covering the picture plane with, like, huge swashes of, like, bright color and then building from that. So, like, you would outline and then add color, so it kind of makes this almost like patchwork, really bright composition. And Pissarro was pissed when Gauguin did this painting and wrote in a letter, "I criticize him for not applying his synthesis to our modern philosophy, which is absolutely social, anti-authoritarian, and anti-mystical," because this painting was somewhat mystical. So he's kind of out in the shits from his old Impressionist buddies. Mm. And, you know, he's going along and he's still painting. I doubt he was very concerned by this because he's a narcissist. and like so many male artists, he got really into painting naked women. And
I mean, obviously.
Word.
And in particular, young naked women. There's a painting called Loss of Virginity, which depicts a barely pubescent young girl.
Yeah.
Lying naked on the ground, and she clutches a fox, which Gauguin claimed was an Indian symbol for perversity. And so it's interesting because from here, there's really more of a development into this emphasis on the primitive and mystical kind of symbolism, and obviously depicting young naked women. And so that's just a kind of brief overview of Gauguin. You can see some of his asshole tendencies, but I promise there's more. So we'll get into those.
It gets dark, you guys. It gets real dark.
Yeah.
Is it like a commonly known thing that Van Gogh and Gauguin were friends?
I think
like
that
I know it
is
in our art history community.
Yeah,
I think so.
But
I don't feel like his name gets dragged into the incident as much as it should.
I totally agree. I think it's known for people who are like big Van Gogh fans, or like if you've studied art history, it's a little more known, but I agree. It's not something you hear about a lot.
Yeah. They were very, very close for a period of time. There's even speculation among like certain art historians that there was like a homosexual relationship there. Mostly Van Gogh was like very enamored with Gauguin. When we went to the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam, remember they had a bunch of his letters?
Mm-hmm.
I felt like, okay, first of all, Van Gogh wrote the most emotionally touching letters to his friends. Like, he just loved his friends. Yeah. And his letters to Gauguin were so just intimate, and he just loved his friends so much that you're like, why do you like this douche?
I know. Yeah. It's like that case of just like the sweetest people getting taken advantage of by like by toxic people, you know.
Yeah, let's get into that. I got some dirt about this. So most of this takes place around like Arles, France, and then Yeah, we'll talk about Arles.
Let's talk about Arles.
Mm-hmm. So, starting in 1988, Van Gogh moved to Arles and had this dream of starting an artist colony, and he really wanted Gauguin to join in and be a part of it because he's his buddy and he loves him. So he wrote him lots of letters trying to convince him, basically pleading for Gauguin to come and stay with him. And finally, Gauguin agrees, and this is after funding for the transportation and expenses included in living here will be covered by Theo,
right,
by Van Gogh's mm-hmm. brother. Right. So right. once he doesn't have to pay, he begrudgingly agrees to come. He only stayed for 2 months, which we'll get into at the end why exactly that happened, but it was a little bit tumultuous of a time. They made some interesting art while living together. This was the time period where they're very heavily influenced by Japanese prints. And mm-hmm. Van Gogh owned a lot of prints and had kind of decorated the Yellow House really cute and hung a lot of these prints and other similar art for inspiration around the Yellow House in anticipation for Gauguin coming. He comes
That's
in.
So sweet.
I know, guys, it gets worse. So he comes in late October and they begin their little two-man artist colony. And it didn't take long for things to start to sour. Gauguin wrote to Bernard, who mm-hmm. Ginny had mentioned, and he said, "In general, Vincent and I see eye to eye on very little, especially on painting." So their fundamental techniques on painting were quite different. Van Gogh focused a lot more on reality. So he wanted to paint things that he saw and just paint them through his eye, whereas Gauguin was kind of painting more from like memory and imagination. Mm-hmm. So his are mm-hmm. a little more abstract. So kind of just a fundamental difference of opinion in how you should paint.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that in these portraits that they painted of one another. So the one by Van Gogh is of Gauguin from behind, and he's actually visibly painting. You know, the reality there is that when someone's painting, you can't really see their face. And it was done on a piece of burlap that Gauguin found and brought for them to paint on. So it's really thick, interesting paint. And he looks into it. Like, you can't see the painting or anything he's doing. It's really just like a side profile. And then the painting that Gauguin did of Van Gogh is called The Painter of Sunflowers. It's believed to be an imaginary scene that, you know, something yeah. mm-hmm. in theory like this would have happened, but it's not painted from life.
Mm-hmm.
Van Gogh was actually pretty upset when he first saw the painting that Gauguin did of him. He said that he looked like a madman.
He does kind of look.
Yeah.
His face is rough.
Yeah. So he took some offense to that. He softened to it later and kind of got over it, and they settled that. Let's move on to where the story gets good.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Poor Vincent.
I know.
They had very heated arguments, these two, over painting a lot of
really?
The time.
Yeah.
It was really about painting. And I cannot fathom getting to the point that these two got in their fights about their artistic vision.
Yeah.
You think at some point you'd just be like, okay, like,
no,
you do you.
That'd be fine.
This was like a war of egos, I believe.
It really did get there.
Passionate.
It got very passionate. So in addition to the portraits that they did of one another, they did self-portraits as gifts for one another.
I love these.
So yeah, they're great. And Bernard, who Ginny mentioned, was also involved in this, but I'm just going to talk about Van Gogh and Gauguin's. So Van Gogh painted himself as like an austere monk.
Mm-hmm. It really looks.
It's
like
a really
it.
Famous self-portrait of his. Mm-hmm.
He looks like an alien.
He kind of does. I had my students draw this in one of the classes, and some of the drawings were great.
I remember seeing these.
Yeah, some were really, really good. He's very gaunt looking. So yeah, he's supposed to be a monk spreading the word of the new art, and that's what he's going for in this painting. Whereas Gauguin's, it's called Self-Portrait with Portrait of Emile Bernard. So he paints Bernard into the photo. Subtitle, Les Miserables. So he's trying to portray himself as Jean Valjean. Am I saying that right?
Yep. Yeah.
Yep. Jean Valjean as a rebellious protagonist.
Shut up.
Yes. He is the worst.
Yeah.
God damn it.
His face, like, he made himself look so, like, debonair. Like,
totally.
Oh, I'm...
I have Jean Valjean.
I'm the shit.
Like, this skeptical kind of, like, outlaw look with the big mustache. And it's just so ridiculous.
Yeah.
But winter approaches in Arles, and they were kind of trapped in the house as it got colder, so they had to spend more time around each other, which is kind of believed to have built the tension up, and their aesthetic debates were getting intense, and it culminated in a fight where Gauguin began saying that he was going to leave and head back to Paris, and Van Gogh got really distraught about this, and this is where the story gets kind of interesting, because the traditional story has been that Van Gogh got so upset that he cut off his own ear, and then Gauguin fled in horror, and then Van Gogh, brought the ear to a prostitute at a brothel?
Right.
Yeah, yeah, so that was the traditional story for a while. And now there are these German art historians who are saying that that is false, and that Gauguin chopped off part of Van Gogh's ear with a sword. And then they had a pact of silence never to speak of it, because Van Gogh didn't want to tarnish Gauguin's name and wanted to protect him.
Because he loved his friend. He loved his friend.
Because the ear thing with Van Gogh, like anyone who doesn't know like anything about art history or Van Gogh, they know about the ear. And it's like, oh, he was crazy. And he chopped it off.
Yeah. And it's like, it might not have even been him. Yeah. And like,
I could see Gauguin
just like whipping a sword
out in a fight. They were probably fighting about like color or some shit, and he just pulled out a sword and
I can picture it so vividly. Who knows, you know,
right?
Who's to say?
I do, though. I want to read the book because it's called Van Gogh's Ear, Paul Gauguin, and the Pact of Silence. So I want to
read that too.
I want to see if it's some compelling evidence. I think it's worth the read.
Yeah.
If any of you guys at home have read it and want to write into us about
let us know.
Yeah, there's another book called The Yellow House, Van Gogh, Gauguin, and the Nine Turbulent Weeks in Arles.
It'd be a great movie. Oh my God, it'd
Martin,
be such a good movie.
Martin Gayford, art critic of Bloomberg Europe. So, yeah, this is a really, really contested issue. What happened? I'm going to just say that I believe that Gauguin had a sword and lopped Van Gogh's ear off. Because I hate him. So I just assume that's what happened.
I'm gonna put out there that we are all taking a very biased stance.
Yeah,
on
this is extremely biased.
We're biased.
You know what? It's our podcast and this is our opinion. So I stand by it. And that was on Christmas Eve.
Day before.
December 23rd. Day before Christmas Eve.
Christmas Eve.
Oh, wow. What
Christmas
a...
Christmas Eve. Like, Eve.
Oh.
Be nice to your friends. And if you have a friend who's an asshole, don't be friends with them anymore.
Yeah, get out of there before they chop your ear off.
And make everyone think you're crazy.
Yeah, get out. Get
cautionary
out.
Tale.
Just don't get to that point, okay?
Like, or just don't hang out with toxic assholes like Gauguin. Don't do it.
You know, the thing that makes me so sad about this is because we all have this soft spot for Van Gogh, and I'm sure he wasn't a saint, but he was good. He was good.
I think he was good.
I think he was good.
I think he was generally good.
I think he was good. And just from the letters alone, Van Gogh was so, so excited to have Gauguin come live with him in the Yellow House. And the fact that it went so badly
and he ended up losing his ear
breaks my heart, dude. Like, it really does. And he was never the same after that. Like, his health, like mental and otherwise, like really took a huge dip after this incident. Does anyone know? I think that they had some more correspondence.
Yeah,
after
they did. That was not the end of their friendship.
So yeah, it wasn't the end of their friendship. One of Van Gogh's final recorded words to Gauguin were, "You are quiet, I will be too."
Dang.
Okay.
I think that's a good place for us to take a quick break. As podcasters, we understand the importance of quality sound. Studio headphones are stylish and sleek with proper sound quality.
If you like on-ear headphones, you know, the ones that make you look like a DJ, you'll love the Regent. With 24 plus hours of active battery life and 20 days of standby life, the Regent is the perfect companion to you at home or on the go.
If you're looking for headphones to meet your more athletic lifestyle, check out the Tre. With 9 plus hours of active battery life and 10 days of standby life. It's made out of sweat-proof material and has custom wing tips that stay comfortably in your ear no matter how you're moving.
These are only two of the many styles that Studio has to offer, so go to studio.com to check them out. Studio emphasizes the modern Scandinavian design while also providing a product that matches the quality of even the highest rated headphones on the market for a fraction of the cost. And they provide free worldwide shipping. Use the discount code BABES to get 15% off any purchase. Go check them out. They're beautiful.
Okay, we are back talking about Paul Gauguin when we last left our anti-hero.
Nice.
He was hanging out with our boy Van Gogh, and things
likely chopped his ear off.
Yeah, basically.
We're just gonna say that's probably what happened.
As we discussed, Van Gogh's health steadily declined, and then he infamously committed suicide, which there is some back and forth on that as well.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know. He's shot himself in the stomach?
Yeah.
Why would you do that?
That's intense.
I read something that was very sad, which was that when Van Gogh was in the hospital recovering from having lopped his ear off / having it lopped off, he called for Gauguin to come see him. He wanted to see him.
Why?
And Gauguin wouldn't come.
Why did he care so much about Gauguin?
Because I think he was in love with him. Why though?
Gauguin was a piece of trash.
Why does anyone fall in love with someone who's horrible?
That's
true. Let's just get that, you know, out there. It happens all the time.
So the next element of our story is, honestly, I mean, you know, I love my boy Van Gogh, and I hate that Gauguin was mean to him, but this next element I think is just the
cream of the shitty crop.
Yeah,
he just goes off the deep end into complete shitheadery.
Yeah.
God. He just goes like full force into
complete
being an asshole.
Fuckery.
Just embraces it entirely.
We are talking about Gauguin's trip to Tahiti. So in 1891, he sets sail for Tahiti. And while he is there, he discovers what he claims to be this beautiful, romantic, erotic garden of Eden, basically. Yeah
just garden. Primitive paradise.
Yeah. Ugh. Just everything that's wrong with the civilized world doesn't exist there. Mm-hmm. It's just a perfect place of sexual debauchery.
Right. This is like at the heart of primitivism.
Mm-hmm.
This,
yeah.
And Gauguin lives it to the fullest. Abandons European culture and goes to live with the primitives.
Abandons European family.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like, abandons.
Yeah, abandons. Yep. And then goes to live with the primitives, a word we've talked about before that's crazy problematic.
Yes, extremely.
And lives it up and is doing life, you know, the right way, the way everyone should be doing it, according to Gauguin.
Right.
Everyone should abandon their their lives and go marry young girls in Tahiti.
Let's marry some 13-year-olds. Yeah.
Yeah. Essentially, what happens is he goes down there. He gets all this artistic inspiration. A lot of the work you've seen by him was from his trip to Tahiti. That's some of his most famous paintings. He also, as a result of his trip, he wrote the book Noah Noah, which is his account of his experience in Tahiti. And he also sleeps with a lot of Tahitian women, many of them 13, 14 years old. He married three of them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Still rape.
Yeah. Just because you marry them, that doesn't
Did he have three of them at the same time?
I think there was some overlap.
Okay.
Because he left for a while.
Right.
And then comes back later. So, yeah.
Hopefully the first one got away by then.
Yeah.
So these images that we see of naked Tahitian women Tahitian women, you know, in nature, or Tahitian women in a bed, like
combing their hair sensually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are all supposedly, they're supposed to represent his experience there. Obviously, like we said, he had a tendency to fib. He really didn't like to paint.
Fib.
He didn't like to paint purely from reality. So, like, some of this is probably a mix of reality and fantasy, but it is representative of the life he was living in Tahiti. And that just, like, raises crazy amounts of questions about his work. Is it okay to like Gauguin's work? What do these paintings mean? I think is, like, the most important question. What do these paintings mean? So, in researching for this episode, the first thing I did was I just Googled Gauguin problematic.
Problematic.
And like a ton of stuff came up. And I literally just picked off like the first three or four. I was like, these are good. And read the headline. So the first one I read was an article by Amelia Hill for The Guardian called Gauguin's Erotic Tahiti Idol Exposed as a Sham.
That's a good title.
I know, right?
Yeah, Gauguin, Sham.
Yeah,
I like it.
Go Sham.
Go Sham. So this article opens, the opening line of the article, Paul Gauguin, renowned for his paintings of exotic idols and Polynesian beauties, was a sadist who battered his wife, exploited his friends, and lied to the world about the erotic Eden he claimed to have discovered on the South Sea island of Tahiti.
I believe it.
Mic drop.
I love it. Just straight out the gate. It's just like,
oof.
That is how you open an essay.
I know, right? Yes. It's so good.
I'm hooked. That's what they were teaching us in writing class. Mm-hmm. Like, get them hooked.
Strozzi be so impressed.
Wow.
Yeah. So this article goes on to talk about, it actually talks about a book that Jen's going to talk about a little later called Paul Gauguin, An Erotic Life, written by Nancy Mole Matthews. Which is a fairly, I don't know what year it came out, but a fairly recent.
I believe it was in 2001.
Okay. So somewhat recent biography of Gauguin. And this article dives into some of the biographical facts that are just often changed or just not addressed. Like we just ignore.
Yeah.
Like for one, so his wife, I don't know if it's pronounced Matt or Maddie.
Maddie Gad. I don't know. It's Dutch, right? She was Dutch.
Yeah, I have Danish. No idea. Yeah.
Danish.
But so his wife, in a lot of things I've been written on Gauguin, has been painted as like a shitty wife, as like mean and
shrew.
Yeah. And according to a lot of letters that you can read, like written by his wife, she was not horrible, but actually pretty kind and clever. You know, it kind of covers Gauguin's ass if the wife that he left was a bitch, you know? Furthermore, like his wife was victimized by him through the entirety of their marriage. There's a written account by their son, Emil. Emil confesses that he had seen his father beat his mother.
No doubt. Yeah.
So domestic abuse, not okay. And then this article is basically bringing to light both these things that we about Gauguin's life that we have just kind of ignored, and then also the fact that a lot of this ideal situation he created was total fabrication.
Yeah.
Another quote, "The island and the realities of Gauguin's life there are virtually unrecognizable in his representations, carefully calculated to intrigue the French audience," said Nancy Mole Matthews, author of Paul Gauguin and Erotic Life. So basically what happened is he goes to Tahiti the first time, and he's there for 2 years, goes back to France in 1893, and he wants to impress everyone in France. So even though he's like all like anti-civilization and he wants to go back to France
of
and
course,
be like,
because he's a narcissist. Here's what people think about him.
He wants to go back to France and be like, look at all this amazing artwork I made in my Tahitian paradise. And like kind of some solace, it doesn't really work. Like not a lot of people give a shit. They're just like, whatever, bro. And
yeah, you weirdo.
Yeah. Right? And he writes Noah, as I said, which is his account of what happened. So once again, very fantasy romanticization. And then in 1895, after 2 years of it just like not working, people not really digging these Tahitian paintings, he goes back to Tahiti.
I must return.
So yeah, he goes back to Tahiti. Let's see. He refers, oh God, he refers to his Tahitian hut as La Maison du Jouir, which means the House of Orgasm.
Oh,
he is so gross.
That's so gross, dude.
That is so gross.
That sounds like what some creepy college bro calls his, like, you know, shitty,
yeah,
like house
for
with
you,
like,
probably, yeah, because you are most likely a selfish lover and never give anyone else an orgasm.
It really does
were
sound
you, were you
like,
talking about someone in particular? That seemed very pointed.
Jenny got like upset. Her face was upset. Whoa.
But yeah, exactly. It's so frat boy gross.
Ew.
Like,
That makes me just feel like slimy. Like,
yeah,
I just,
right? And then the fact that he was sleeping with a lot of teenage girls, young mm-hmm. teenage girls. Like,
yeah. And we need to like address this now. Gauguin certainly had syphilis.
Certainly.
He certainly had syphilis. There
it was quite advanced by that point, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, according to the art historian that we just talked about, Mull Matthews, she suggests in her book that yes, Gauguin returned to Paris in 1893 to not only exhibit some of his paintings, try to sell some of his paintings, but he had also largely run out of money. So he actually had to depend on a grant for a free passage back home. And he was having some serious health problems at the time, heart problems that Matthews suggests may have been the early signs of cardiovascular syphilis. So not only is he out there living in the House of Orgasms, but he's giving like young girls syphilis.
Upsetting. Yeah.
So
he gave a lot of women
so
syphilis.
Just, you know, chew on that.
Yeah. Oh God damn it. As I mentioned, he wrote Noah Noah, which was published in 1901, which totally romanticizes his experience, was probably written to help sell paintings. And I have this quote from it, which is really interesting. Because this is something that I feel like, I mean, if I was back in grad school, this would make such a killer thesis topic. Paul Gauguin was often considered a feminist.
Oh, Jesus.
Because he painted women?
No. There's reason like, behind it. there's reason behind it, but it's like, I see why. And I'll read this quote. And you'll kind of see where this comes from. But he just obviously got feminism so wrong. So this quote is from his book. Thanks to our cinctures and corsets, we have succeeded in making an artificial being out of woman. She is an anomaly in nature herself, obedient to the laws of heredity, aids us in complicating and enervating her. We carefully keep her in a state of nervous weakness and muscular inferiority. And in guarding her from fatigue, we take away from her possibilities of development. Thus modeled on a bizarre ideal of slenderness to which, strangely enough, we continue to adhere, our women have nothing in common with us, and this perhaps may not be without grave moral and social disadvantages. So he's talking about women in contemporary civilized society.
Yeah.
That is a feminist stance. Like, yeah, that yeah. little bit is. But it's like, how can you get it so wrong?
Right.
Yeah.
Like, maybe that cancels out 1% of his shitty things he's done
to
women.
You know what's
like,
not a feminist stance? Is marrying a 13-year-old who... Apparently, he met her and married her in the same afternoon, known as Teja Amana, that was her name, who was pregnant by him by the end of the same summer, 13 years old.
Yeah, so he's gross and like, and
I
that
mean, it's just like
condescending, like, I'm
exactly,
so, I'm so enlightened and I'm an enlightened like feminist and no.
That's like every guy that you meet that says he's a feminist and tries to use it as a way to get into your pants. Like,
right. Like no,
we've
bro.
Seen
I'm
it
so glad
before.
I've not come across one of those men.
Oh, I've come across a lot of those men, and it's gross.
Or like Harvey Weinstein being like, I'm with her.
Oh, jeez.
Marching in the women's march. It's like, no, you're a piece of shit. Right? You are not a feminist. So, nope.
God.
Not enough.
Definitely not enough. But yeah, but at that time, that's a fairly radical stance, you know, to have.
Yeah.
So he returned to Tahiti. This is another quote from that article. He returned expecting the erotic idol that was only ever a figment of his imagination. Of course, he didn't find it, and the disappointment was profound. He died a twisted and bitter man, having alienated everyone both at home and in Tahiti.
Damn.
It's a sad story of a man who believed his own fiction.
Twisted. He was a twisted man.
Fantastic.
Oh, I love that.
Fantastic.
So that article's dope.
Yeah.
It's super short. It'll be up on our sources, but hats off to you, Amelia Hill.
Your words were strong, Amelia.
Yeah, definitely enjoy that take. Now, for something different, one of the other articles that popped up right away was also from The Guardian, and it was called Paul Gauguin, Guilty as Charged, by Adrian Searle. Now, I am making assumptions about gender identification. I don't know for a fact that Adrian is a male and that Amelia is a female. So I'm putting that out there.
Okay.
But I have a feeling.
What is this person's name? Adrian what now?
Adrian Searle.
Adrian Searle.
Oh, I think it's a dude. It's a dude.
Oh, right. Here we go.
It's a dude.
It is.
Okay.
Now we know.
All right. So.
So now let it rip.
All right. So this one opens. Colonialist, chauvinist, exploiter. Gauguin may have been all these things and more, but as the Tate's brilliant new show reveals, his faults are what make him great.
Oh.
No.
Are you fucking kidding me? Like, are you kidding
his
me?
His faults? Oh, no. Like, they're just faults, you know? Like, he was a flawed man.
Yeah, like
he liked teenage girls. It was a flaw.
Colonialist, chauvinist, exploiter, like, faults? Like, are you kidding me?
Oh, man.
I was just, like, so... Just straight out the gate, I was like, oh, this is ridiculous. And even just the title, Paul Gauguin, Guilty as Charged.
Oh, Lord.
Like, that's just a gross title. Trying to make it cool.
Yeah. You.
Yeah, it's gross. I hope you hear this, Adrian, because it's gross.
Yeah, Adrian, you messed up. I don't know what you're thinking, bro.
Like, most of the stuff was him bringing to light these bad things about Gauguin, but it was ultimately just praising Gauguin's work.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, so you're saying this, this, and this, but his work is still great, and it's kind of great because he was terrible. And it's just like, it was not done in a way that actually picked apart what all these bad behaviors, like, meant, like... You can't separate the man from his work. Like, they are interrelated, you know? And it just kind of was like, yeah, I'm going to be honest. Like, Gauguin did all these things, but how about that sermon painting, you know? Like,
stop.
And then another article for The Telegraph called Is It Wrong to Admire Paul Gauguin's Art by Alastair Smart. Here's a quote from it. The trouble with aesthetes.
I think that's the one, let's go with aesthetes. I feel good about that.
Oh my god,
I love that word on paper. I think it's spelled really pretty, but it's hard to pronounce.
Oh man,
aesthetes. Yeah, I don't know. The trouble with aesthetes.
12 years old, apparently.
Oh my god. Okay.
Serious.
The trouble we aesthetes have, though, is that in Gauguin's case, just like Van Gogh's, his life was so dramatic it's hard not to read the biography onto the art. Indeed, much of the power of his most famous works, the Polynesian Babe paintings,
what
derives from our uncomfortable knowledge of the context they were created in. Although rendered innocent and unerotic, These brown-skinned nudes were more than just Gauguin's models. They were his sex slaves, too.
Whoa.
And, like, first off, who deemed these paintings innocent and unerotic?
I don't think you can escape the eroticism.
I don't think you can either. Who thought these were innocent?
That whole quote just was dripping.
A damned fool.
That whole quote was just dripping with, like, salacious, like, ooh, ha, 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 ooh. Like, I just get this.
A man named Alistair said babes is weird to me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, come on.
Exactly. And once again, these Polynesian babes were, like, 13 and 14 years old.
Yeah, they were babes in the sense that they were children.
This brings me to, I think, like, the biggest question, and we kind of opened the episode with it a little bit. Is it wrong to admire Paul Gauguin's art? I personally certainly think it's wrong to admire the quote-unquote Polynesian babe paintings. Mm. I, like, have some serious problems with those. There are some of his work that I can kind of separate a little bit, but, like, the context of those paintings is so important. It is what they are, you know? Like,
let's just play a little game here and think about what would happen if those were 13-year-old white girls.
Right?
Whoop. Dang. Natalie just came in with a bombshell. It's
like,
true.
No one would want to hang that in a museum and look at it. They would consider it repulsive.
Exactly.
Like, it is such an example of colonialism and just objectifying these women.
Yeah. Eroticizing, like, objectifying the so-called primitive brown woman, this sort of untainted, the sense that they are living in, like, a land before time, you know?
Yeah, well, and it's also just, I mean, the sexualization of the black woman, you know? Like, like, historically, especially in this time frame, like, black women were thought to be inherently sexual, while white women were supposed to be pure, you know? Yeah. It's so gross, but, like, that's why these paintings are okay, you know?
So, a lot of this idea of, can we admire Gauguin? There's some argument that, well, he took such great care to delineate the Polynesian features of these women, and that somehow it gives him some level of credibility or respectability for accurately portraying these women. But at the same time, they're not women. They're girls.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, I have trouble because I actually kind of like this painting from 1891, A Woman with a Flower. Mm-hmm. It's quite beautiful. The woman is wearing what look like a Western type of dress, holding a flower. Kind of interesting because the background is composed largely of yellow and red, supposedly. Gauguin hated yellow, so interesting. And Van Gogh hated red, and the two are together, so I just want to point that out. Just because. But this is so, it's like a tiny little speck of, like, okay, sure, he portrayed them accurately, and then what?
Yeah, no, this painting, like, she's not sexualized. Well, like,
right,
like, it's someone sitting for a portrait, which is not as problematic. I mean, it's still problematic for, like, all the colonial reasons, you know? Right.
And then take, for instance, Spirit of the Dead Watching from 1892. It is so gross to look at. I really hate this painting. Some have compared her to the Tahitian Olympia.
Oh, yes. Oh, my God. This painting. This painting.
Makes me feel gross.
It's the worst.
I don't understand how someone can look at this painting and know that this is his 13-year-old lover and she's on a bed nude and you're seeing her from behind and she's kind of looking back and he paints this sort of coy expression on her face, and
I doubt
exactly. And so these paintings are gross.
Yeah, it, like, this painting, this one I was shown to me in undergrad,
which same.
Sparked my hatred for this man because mm-hmm. I had a bad ass professor. Mm-hmm. She was just like not having any of this bullshit. And it's one of those things that these paintings, like, yeah, this one is super just unsettling.
The longer I look at it, the grosser I feel. I can't look at it.
Yeah.
Anymore.
Yeah. And a lot of those paintings that involve these Tahitian women nude, Tahitian girls nude, for, you know, I'd seen them before, but I never stopped to really think about what they meant, you know, when I was younger, like when I was in high school and yeah. stuff. I never stopped to really think about what was going on in these paintings or, you know, who painted them. And so this undergrad class was the first time I actually like, took the time to stop and look and realize how fucked up it was. And a little exercise that our professor pulled out, which I think is brilliant. We were talking about Gauguin, and she pulled up a picture of, which I have one here, of a tote bag that is sold
yep.
with a Gauguin painting on it. And it's a painting of nude Tahitian women. Mm-hmm. And this one is Gauguin's Day of the God tote that is sold at the Chicago Art Institute Museum store. And I love the Chicago Art Institute. Yeah. It's a great museum. And it's a tote bag. And like, what the fuck does it mean to be carrying this image around on your shoulder?
Yeah.
Like, think about that. Mm. It's an image of a white man's privilege and exploitation and
yep.
and you're just like carrying around your Kindle in it, you know?
Yeah.
That
it's perverse.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the only word for it.
Messed up.
It's a perverse action that it's like a double objectification, mm-hmm. you know?
It's like, well, we added capitalism into the mix. Right. So we yep. did.
Of course. Of course we did.
This is probably like a $45 tote bag.
Yeah.
I just imagine like a 50-year-old woman named Karen yeah. with this bag, you know? And she's got some like,
it's like, oh, my
sassy colored reading glasses. Yeah. And she just thinks it's all that.
Karen, you don't know what you're doing.
Like, yeah, my trip to Chicago was yeah. wonderful. Like, we had such a nice time.
God damn it, Karen.
It's something.
Yeah, it is something. And that is where we get really murky with Gauguin, because it shouldn't be murky. It should never be murky. It should just be gross. But there are a lot of art historians that really argue that Gauguin is this amazing painter and that he contributed so much and that he ushered in like symbolism and fauvism and all these things and that he was so revolutionary. And I really don't see it.
Yeah, no, like, you know? I mean, like some of his paintings are fine, but I guess I don't think he did anything that revolutionary that other people weren't doing.
No. Yeah.
Like, I would take Van Gogh any day, mm-hmm. any day. Yeah. And then you add in all this other bullshit, and then you add in the, not only the man, but the images themselves and yeah. what they are of.
Right.
And it's like, what it, like,
what is
you,
there to argue?
Yeah, what are you admiring so much? And why are you so bent on not, like, letting go? That's
right.
the thing. There are multiple art historians that they
won't let go.
They will not let go of Gauguin, yeah. and I don't get it. I don't get it.
On that note, I want to talk a little bit about Nancy Mal Matthews' book, Paul Gauguin, An Erotic Life. We touched a little bit about it earlier. I feel that Matthews is completely wilding when they ask her in an interview with Salon. They're asking her essentially, how do you reconcile these heinous sexual acts that Gauguin most certainly engaged in? They say, the interviewer doesn't really ask her, he just says, you don't make a lot of moral judgment on Gauguin in your book. Her response, this is what I would say about pedophilia or abuses in his sexual relationships. I think in practice it is abominable and should never be perpetuated against unwilling or too innocent people, children or whatever.
Whatever.
Oh, okay. I think what I admire Gauguin for, I think I can say this, is when he put these odd and unpredictable twists of sexuality into his art that actually ended up enhancing it. So even people who would say, absolutely not, we can't have the sexualization of children, or we can't have any glorification of violence within a marriage or a sexual relationship, the way Gauguin used those themes in his art ended up being quite compelling. What are you talking about? Are you serious?
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's like going back to the Woody Allen thing, like the fact that he made movies about like old creepy dudes like being in love with people they shouldn't be in love with, and then he married his daughter because he's gross. Like,
oh my god!
And then people are like, "It's okay because his art's so good." It's like, no, it's not.
And Matthews, I'm sure, is an art historian of caliber, but I think she lost her damn mind. The interviewer goes on to ask her of an example of sexual violence in his work, and she points out a series of Eves that he did in the late 1880s. So this is in his Breton time, where he's in Brittany admiring these kind of like untouched peasant women that they're, you know, they're so just rural and simple. And he paints a series of Eves, and he calls them that. And one of the Eves from 1889 is shown covering her ears, and her mouth is open as if she is crying out. And behind her is the snake. And this is a very different sort of Eve with the snake.
Yeah.
When we see Eve with the snake in traditional biblical paintings, she's very like, oh, and seems to be very enchanted by the snake. In this painting, the snake is preying on her. It's a predatory painting. It's kind of creepy. She doesn't want to listen to the snake. She's looks distressed. She also brings in another example. Paul Gauguin did a number of wood sculptures and carvings. There's a quite famous one. The title is commonly translated to "Be in love and you will be happy." But Matthews claims it actually says "be a lover." And it therefore gives it a very forceful and perverse kind of undertone. The woodcut itself is just bizarre. It's hard to tell what's really going on here, but there's a woman on the left side of the panel is shown being grasped by her arm by a man who is supposed to be Gauguin himself, actually. And we see another Eve with her hands over her ears. There's this wolf or dog. I can't tell what it is. It's a very bizarre carving. I don't get this like happy sense, like be in love and you will be happy
about this.
There's literally, it is menacing. It is terrifying. What is this face with the thumb?
Yeah.
And like the thumb is like in the mouth.
Yeah.
It's probably, and it just,
probably just being a weirdo.
It's very strange and I hate it.
It is very strange.
So she discusses Gauguin's favorite themes, or one of his favorite themes is this idea of a young woman being introduced to sexuality, going back to 1891.
Of course it is.
Right.
Yeah.
Going back to the painting, The Loss of Virginity, in parentheses, The Awakening of Spring. So we discuss this. There's a naked woman. She's in a field. There's this fox on her shoulder that she is holding. There is a crushed flower in her right hand. This kind of symbolism of deflowerment. There's nothing beautiful about this. This whole notion that this introduction to sexuality, it really has this connotation that she becomes isolated because of this introduction. In the background, very far away, there seems to be a group of people, and she's in the foreground completely nude in just a field, like by herself. I don't know what happened here. It's just creepy.
Yeah, it doesn't look like the type of setting you'd want to, I don't know, have sex for the first time.
No, yeah, there's like people on a path in the distance.
Yeah, it's very strange. And to go on, the salon, the interviewer from Salon just comes straight out and asks, "Don't you think it's a contradiction to appreciate Gauguin's perverse message in his art, but reject it in his life?" Matthews responds, "It seems like there should be a contradiction, but I feel comfortable with it. I feel it's okay to interject unpredictable ideas into a work of art as long as you're not perpetuating those acts against living human beings. Is that what you're thinking is a contradiction? When I think of Gauguin's work, I think of the very offensive idea that seems to be a part of them. Take Spirit of the Dead Watching. That is the most thorny of all his paintings. It's kind of like the loss of virginity. It seems to be a continuation of that theme. Young girl, very androgynous looking, virtually the same body type. Thick ankles, short legs, but nevertheless youthful and attractive. In this case, there's fear in the painting. More like the Eve, where the fact of her nudity and suggestion of sexuality makes her afraid. She's looking out at whoever is observing her with fear. Good job at not answering the question, at all.
Yeah,
that is exactly what I was thinking. I was like, okay, she
could be a politician with that shit.
Right? That was some Trump voodoo right there.
So this is so disappointing to me. This idea of a female art historian going through the trouble of writing a whole book on this guy and just defending him.
Yeah.
And
especially because she's doing it from a perspective that I think she is bringing to light stuff that needs to be brought to light, because this is the same book that brings up how he beat his wife and stuff. So it's right. Like she's bringing she also talks a lot about how this was a romanticized ideal, you know, that he had created. And so she's like digging deep into the reality of the situation, but still won't take it there. Like she won't take a stance on it because people just like aren't willing to hold white male artists accountable. Like it's just like, oh, but the art's separate. And
yeah,
that's not it. Like,
and especially in this case, because it's not separate. It's
right?
Depicting the problematic things. Like,
exactly.
You know, I'm just very bothered with this idea that because Gauguin had this reprehensible tendency to have sex with 13-year-olds, that somehow contributes a sort of compellingness to his work. That's who says that?
Yeah, right. Like if a known pedophile started paintings like that today, like, but they were just really beautiful, like they were just like the technique was really interesting, would that be okay? Like, God, no. Well, like, that would not be okay.
And that's what, this is just so crazy to me. And I just can't understand it. And I don't know what to do with it. I don't know how to respond to our art historians who not only either choose to ignore it completely, which is usually the case, or kind of talk about it, but they're like, well, you know, he did that. But like in this case, knowing 100% what he was doing, writing it in a book, and then saying that it enhances the art.
Yeah.
That is crazy talk.
Yeah.
She lost her damn mind.
And once again, we're not talking about him just kind of being like a shitty dude. Like, we're talking about the victimization of young girls.
It almost feels like she said it, and then it's like you just can't really go back from saying that. So she just has to lean in.
Because, exactly.
Like, you can't. Act like that's okay.
Yeah, right?
She had to at some point realize this is not okay.
No, I mean, and she did, you know,
but she feels like she can't.
I mean she does sort of end this interview with a little bit a sort of like, well, no, I mean, he was a really bad guy. the quote here, she says, "This man was the worst bully, the most ungrateful husband. It was the unrelenting criticism of his wife that began to turn my stomach. This is a man you never want to be involved with. He could really do some damage to you." Oh, so you read the letters to his wife and that's what turned your stomach.
Right.
It's just, this is ridiculous.
Yeah. And I mean, that is a thing. Like, yeah, let's talk about his wife because she was probably a way better person than
which
you.
Which one?
Yeah. But yeah, exactly. Like, but that, I mean, that's a super important point, too, like that she's ready to defend Gauguin's European wife. But jinx.
You owe me a soda.
Feminist jinx. Yeah. But yet she will stand back and allow pedophilia of young colored girls. That's fine.
I want an explanation. And I want you to answer that question that you were asked in this interview.
That interviewer, that whoever interviewed her was like, yeah, getting it the good content.
I guess so, but you know what? Answers. Whoever it was did not push, and I would have pushed. So I'm pushing.
Maybe you should write her a letter. Like,
I might write her a letter.
Try to get a hold of her. Start, have it out in person.
Start some art history beef.
Oh yeah, let's
you know
do
I
it.
Love beef.
Oh man, we could totally do a like live debate. Oh my god, that would be dope.
I'm really down for that.
That would actually be really cool.
Oh, I'm heated right now. I'm upset.
I mean, like, I'm always upset when thinking about this guy. Like, it's been a gradual thing. Like, over the more and more I learn, the more and more the fire in my belly grows, you know?
Truly.
And, like, there was definitely a time in my life where I was like, oh, yeah, go Gan. Like, yeah, this stuff's all right. Oh, you know, man. Like, I didn't really think anything of it. And now it's just like,
you know,
fire of a thousand suns.
The first Go Gan painting I ever saw was Yellow Christ. And I really hated that painting. Just from the get-go, I was like, why does he have crab claws? Like, what is going on here? Yellow Christ? Jesus Christ, you know? Like, I just didn't know what to think about it. And that was really my introduction to Gauguin, was why is everyone make such a big deal out of this guy? I mean, someone explain it to me, because I don't get it. And I plan to read this book, actually. I will be reading Paul Gauguin, An Erotic Life, because when I do have my debate with Nancy Mal Matthews, I want to come prepared with a lot of the material. Yeah. So I'm going to read your book, Nancy, and then we're going to talk. Because I'm really having problems.
Are you going to talk, or are you going to have it out in an alleyway? Because like,
it depends on how the talk goes. So
you guys will have an intellectual battle.
I'm good at those.
You are.
You know, I'm fine with that.
You got that. You got the passion. Like, do you want to bring up this last upsetting little fun fact?
Oh God. Yeah. So research is fun and takes you all over the place. And while I was doing my research, I happened to come across this just totally outrageous website. You guys can't see this, but we're looking at it right now.
Oh my God.
Here's the website.
That's
that
so fucked.
Advertises
so fucked.
Paul Gauguin cruises.
Ugh.
You can take a Paul Gauguin cruise on the Gauguin, and you go to Tahiti. So you on the Gauguin, you can you'll have all these complimentary amenities, a gathering featuring a Polynesian blessing ceremony performed by Les Gauguins, our onboard troupe of hostess/entertainers.
I don't like that at all.
No,
you'll get an exclusive pillow.
Does it fucking say Gauguin on it?
I don't know. Probably.
It's just like, it's his self-portrait. Like,
lie with me tonight.
No, it's the picture of him kissing that woman on the face when she so clearly doesn't want it.
God, we'll post that picture.
So this entire thing here is, it's a honeymoon cruise. It's a wedding cruise. You can actually get married, a Polynesian wedding ceremony. So that's what they're
Please
selling
it,
you
guys.
On here.
Don't
do they
do
let
it.
You marry children?
Oh my God. I'm not
we
touching
should,
that.
We should get on it and burn that motherfucker down.
Yeah.
Or just go and just be super critical.
Yeah.
Just
be like, we're
this is bullshit. A strongly worded letter. Excuse me. You know not what you do.
I mean, the picture, like the photo on the website is just, in and of itself, just annoying. It's this older white couple with the flower wreath on their head. Mm-hmm. Just like,
they're the world's whitest couple.
And then surrounded by like these Polynesian women. This girl is like, it ain't gonna last.
She's probably hexing them.
Yeah. What the spirit of the dead are watching. God, I could not believe this when I found
this. I'm glad you looked into that, because I had briefly seen in my research like Gauguin cruise, and I just didn't look at it further. Like, I know there's also a Gauguin wine.
Oh yeah.
Oh, there
gross.
Is.
Yeah. It's not good.
But they spelled it different.
They don't spell Gauguin correctly.
I saw
Are they trying to be Gauguin?
Yeah, because there's a painting.
There's the painting. I saw that.
Don't use his name for any branding. Just do yourself a favor. If you're trying to come up with a name for a new thing, don't fucking use Gauguin.
Yeah, why?
There's so many artists' names you could maybe choose from.
Can we briefly, you guys brought it up, but briefly talk about this picture of him kissing a Tahitian woman?
Yeah, look where his hand is on the other chick.
Oh my God, it's so gross. And look at her face. This is photo evidence, man. Like, photo evidence of this gross man.
I hate... Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Her face.
Isn't that gross?
She's like, please get him off of me, please.
She's just so over it. Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. What is this photo? What's the context here? Is he...
It's from a hyperallergic article where they have archival photos of his time in Tahiti.
Okay.
It's linked in our sources, and there are some other photos in there, too.
I have seen some photos of him with various of his Tahitian wives slash girlfriends. They all look very uncomfortable all the time.
We'll link in our sources the amazing... comic that Hyperallergic posted, the syphilitic life of Paul Gauguin.
It's so good. It's so good.
Just a nice breakdown of his stupid life.
His stupid life.
Oh, man.
Good Lord.
He just looks like a predator in every one of these photos. He just...
Because he is a predator.
I know.
He looks like what he is.
Like,
God. Okay.
Fuck Gauguin.
Fuck Gauguin, dude.
Fuck Gauguin. Should we... do a listener mail?
Yeah.
Sure. All right. This one starts, "Hola, babes. I just want to say the art history babes make my day go so fast. I'm a jewelry designer based in Brooklyn, and days in the studio are long. I have a bachelor's degree in fine arts, and I've been meaning to expand my art history knowledge for a long time. I'm so glad I found your podcast. Could you send me an address? I want to send you a thank you gift. P.S. I recently listened to your Paint It Black episode and thought you might be interested in this article about Anish Kapoor's bizarre art feud." And this is from Ale.
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 Thank you. That is
we'll
so
send
kind.
You our address, certainly.
Yeah.
But did you guys read about this at all? About the Anish Kapoor?
I did not.
Because he was the one who, like, bought Vanta Black. He bought the rights to Vanta Black.
Right.
Yeah.
Cool. Right.
So, like, there's been this whole pushback of, like, people trying to, like, I think it was the Pinkest Pink, maybe. It was, they created, I'm pretty sure it was a Pinkest Pink that was created, and then it is available to everyone but Anish Kapoor.
Nice.
That's really funny.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, what a, like,
douchey thing,
big
right?
baby. Like, yeah. Okay, you're just gonna buy it and then no one else can use it.
Yeah, I didn't realize he was hoarding it after he bought it.
Oh yeah, it was just for him. He's the designer of Cloud Gate in Chicago, the Bean. Yeah, and his whole thing, he wanted to paint the Bean black, which I think he did do, actually.
Really? I haven't seen the black Bean.
I know he was at least talking about it. I don't know if he did it. And I love Cloud Gate. Like, it's cool, but. Yeah, he bought exclusively the rights, and so it's turned into this whole, like, art world trying to keep colors from Anish Kapoor.
Hold up. Did he paint the Bean black?
Did you find it?
I think I did. I don't know. Is this real? What?
That looks sick.
That is so black.
That looks sick. That looks really cool.
Well, I'm glad he painted the Bean black, but I want him to stop being a stingy bastard and let other people use it.
Did he need all the Vanta Black for the Bean? Like, was
that's it.
Yeah, he just used all of it. He's like, that's all I wanted to do. I just wanted to paint my Bean black.
Just let me paint my Bean.
Apparently he did this in 2016.
Dope.
Anyway, okay.
Well, thank you so much for your wonderful letter, and we'll definitely send you our information. We love getting gifts from listeners.
We really do.
We really do.
I love it.
If you have thoughts on anything from this episode, or if you just want to, like, rant about Gauguin, you can send that our
Please.
Way. We'd love to read it. You can email us at arthistorybabes@gmail.com. You can find us on every form of social media that is out there.
We're on everything.
You can also head over to our Patreon for extra episodes. Donate to our Patreon, patreon.com/arthistorybabes. Help keep the art history babes moving and shaking.
Grooving. Doing it.
Doing it. We appreciate you all so much. Thank you for listening to this very special episode.
We hope you enjoyed it as much as we enjoyed recording it.
It was cathartic.
It was cathartic.
I feel good.
So I feel like I can just wipe my hands of this man and walk away now.
Yeah.
Yes.
Bye-bye, Gauguin.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
From Cabernet to Monet, they're here to slay the art history bay.
We will make it happen.
We will
hey.
Figure it out.
I said, hey,
yeah, yeah,
hey, yeah, yeah.
I said, hey, what's going on?
That was beautiful.
The Art History Babes podcast is made possible by support from our lovely listeners via Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/arthistorybabes to help keep the Art History Babes going and for access to bonus content.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.